Morning is entitled Love Motivated Leadership. I want to focus on husbands, not so much on wives right at this point. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For. That word for is, and in other places, and could easily be right here, translated because. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord because there's a reason. Here's a God-given reason, an inspired apostolic reason for women submitting to their husbands. As to the Lord, submit to their husbands out of respect to the Lord, out of obedience to the Lord. We might even argue that as to the Lord means respect your husband as though he were the Lord himself. Give him that kind of obedience and submission as to the Lord. It's pleasing to the Lord. It's required by the Lord. And when you do it, the Lord accepts that as obedience done unto Him, as to the Lord. Not because your husband may be necessarily always worthy of it, but the Lord is always worthy. For the husband is the head. That's the reason. Because, wives, submit to your own husbands because the husband is the head of the wife. That's the reason why, because the husband is the head. Even as Christ is the head of the church, His body, and is Himself its Savior, now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her, that He might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the Word, so that He might present the church to Himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we're members of His body. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Now, brethren, 2 weeks ago, last time we dealt with this subject, I used a verse out of 1 John chapter 4, Verse 20, you don't have to turn there. Stay right here in Ephesians 5. You can kind of camp out here because we're going to keep coming back to this. But in 1 John 4:20, many of you are familiar with this text. If you were here 2 weeks ago, you're familiar with it. If anyone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love God, whom he has not seen. Now, why did I bring up that text with regards to being a husband? For this reason, John is laying down a very important principle there. It's very easy to say that you love that which you don't see. Very easy to love people in faraway places. Very easy to love the Indian people to whom John and Judy are going to when you don't know them. Very easy to love God whom you have not seen. You know, you can kind of construct Him in your mind the way you want. Very easy to love that which isn't seen. But basically what he's saying here is your measure of love for the unseen really can be tested by your love for the seen. And the whole argument that I brought forth 2 weeks ago is this. Men who are married have nobody in their life, typically, who is more seen by them than their wife. And my point was this. Men, the way you love your wife is really a test of your love altogether. Love is that first aspect of the fruit of the Spirit. It is something that is true about your life. If love is there, it is there. And one of the primary places and first places that it's going to be seen is in your wife, because she is closest. She is the most seen. Just like a brother seen by us and God not seen by us, in John's mind, you know, they're in two different categories. Or in the same way, I would say that the way we love other people who are less seen and we love our wife who is more seen, we can put them in those two categories. And the one category basically gives us definition for the other one. Our love for that which is seen helps define and really condone and verify and support the authenticity and the reality of our love for that which isn't seen. Look, John's not coming along and saying nobody does love God who isn't seen. He's just saying, look, if you're not loving your brother, and I basically take that same principle and apply it to us men. If you're not loving your wife, then any love you say you've got for other people is suspect. Because if they got as close to you as your wife was, they would find you to be the same way. That's basically what I was arguing for last time. I think that's John's logic here, and I think that's a good way to think. My point in all this is just here, that I believe that if this church is going to grow in its love, in its humility, that for one, men, we've got to be the pace setters in this. And if we're going to be the pace setters in it, it's got to start with our wives. Because if we fail there, brethren, we're failing. You cannot... Look, just as you couldn't convince John that you have love for God if you're not loving your brother, my brothers, if you're not loving your wife, who are you going to convince that you're loving anybody else? Love is just not going to be a trademark of this church. And I believe that Jesus Christ is very concerned about the love of this church, just like he was to Thyatira. Revelation 2:18, the angel of the church in Thyatira, right? The words of the Son of God, who has eyes like a flame of fire and whose feet are like burnished bronze. Listen to what he says. I know your works, your love, and faith and service and patient endurance, and that your later works exceed the first. Jesus Christ is very concerned about the love of this church. No question. He's watching. He sees our works. Brother, he knows we have zeal, no doubt. But what we want the Lord to... What we want the Lord to see is just what he saw there in Thyatira. Now, they had some other things wrong, no doubt, but he knew their love. Brethren, that's really important. Why? For this very reason. We know, as we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, brethren, we can have all this sacrifice, we can have all this faith, we can have all this zeal, but if we don't have love, what does it say? It says we're nothing. And when you get down to the end, it says you've got faith and you've got hope and you've got love. What does it say about love? Anybody know? What's that? It's greatest. Love is the greatest. It's the first there in the fruit of the Spirit. In fact, it's really a test of Christianity altogether. John tells us as much. He says, we know that we have passed out of death into life because we love. And he says the brothers there. But as I argued, our wives come closer a lot of times than the brothers because they're more seen by us. They live closest to us. The Lord is not indifferent about all this. I don't believe we stand a chance of being characterized by true love and humility unless the men in this church are striving in this very area. This has got to be a starting point. This has got to be a place of major priority. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Now, men, you see it there. Basic sentence structure. You've got your primary subject, husbands. Your primary verb, love. You focus in on love. Let me tell you three things about that word in the original. It's in the imperative mood. So it's a commandment. But, brethren, it's not just try to be nice to your wife. This is a commandment. Look, when it says it like this, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. You understand, Paul isn't just saying, here's the imperative of God, try to be nice to your wife. If you really take this imperative for what he says here, what he's saying is, we are under mandate from God to sit at the feet of Jesus Christ and learn of him, and learn his character, and learn his sacrifice, and learn his love, to study. Brethren, that is, do you all see it there? That is part of this imperative, as Christ loved the church and gave himself. If you're not studying to know Christ, if you're not laboring, if you're not working, if that is not part of your, part of what you're giving yourself to in diligent aspect, brethren, then you can't carry this out. It doesn't say to love your wives like Genghis Khan or love your wife like anybody else. Genghis Khan probably wasn't really loving to his wife. But you can fill anybody else in there. I mean, yes, there's a place for imitating, following people in as much as they imitate Christ. Paul would tell us such things. But brethren, the example that we're given here is Jesus Christ himself. That's the imperative. We have to study his love, his sacrifice. And then men, the commandment is to reflect those realities back to your wife. Do you all see that? If you just go away saying, well, yes, I see God commands me to love my wife, you've missed really one of the essential components of this whole thing. The whole thing here is Paul is saying, men, for you to properly love your wife, you have to be a student of Christ. That's what he's saying. Don't miss that. That's like so essential in all of this. You miss that, we're headed for failure. So, the imperative mood. But then we also have this. This verb is active in voice. Now, brethren, I know this is really simple stuff. But when the voice of a verb is active, what does it mean? Active over against what? Passive. See, when something is passive, it means that the verb is done to the subject. Here, it means that the subject, the husband, is to do it. It doesn't say somebody else is going to do this for you. Husbands, you're actually to do the action described by this verb. You must be proactive. Look, it's kind of like this. Any of you men ever tried to have a nice, green, luxuriant lawn in Texas? I tried that once. I've given up. I'm not going to do it. I don't have time. I mean, you basically have to be like you have to be a gardener every day. You have to meticulously. You see, brethren, that's a whole lot like the activity that would be required to nurture that kind of lawn or that kind of garden. Or, I mean, you can apply it to sports. You ever find anybody that really excelled at a sport who took it lightly, didn't apply himself? Just, I mean, yeah, guys, when they're younger, they may get through that, but brethren, I guarantee you this, you don't excel. You don't really excel unless you apply yourself. It's the same thing. There needs to be active, aggressive application. You cannot just say, well, this is going to basically happen naturally. This is going to happen. I don't really have to apply myself to it. Brethren, you're called to action here. The third thing about it is it's present intense. Paul doesn't want you to think about loving your wife tomorrow, perhaps next year. And see, here's the thing. You know what happens when you have a present tense like this? It's like, okay, I loved my wife. I did that. Okay, now, Lord, now what do you want me to do? Well, see, the problem is when it's present like that, you come back to the word and you read, I just got done loving her. But then you read it again and what does it say? Husbands, love your wife. You see, you can never get away from it. Because wherever you are, it's keep keeps telling you that you have to keep loving your wife. It's never like, okay, I got that out of the way, that's all done, let's move on to the next thing. It's not like that at all. You keep coming back to this verse, guess what? It says the same thing every time. Now, some of you ladies are probably thinking, I just thought as I was doing this, does my husband really have to be told all this? Does he really have to be pressed by all this? Does he really have to be taught? Does he have to work so hard? I mean, is it that hard? My sisters, it is. It is. I mean, I know when Brother Andy was here, he said that the text that caused him to squirm most, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, first three verses. Brethren, I talked to him privately. You know where he applied that? Highest, foremost. What's the principle I'm bringing out? If love is the most fearful thing in the Scripture, men, it hits closest to home when it comes to our wives. He testified to that. Well, here it is. The question that just hits us right between the eyes is how? How do I do this? How do I love my wife? Someone's going to say, well, just do it like Christ loved the church. That's what it says. Yeah, but what does that mean? What does that look like in real life? That's what I want to try to begin to answering this morning with Paul's help. How do we love our wives like Christ loved the church? Well, I believe we have to start in verse 23. Because that certainly gives us men some help. Some of you ladies, again, you might not think we need to be taught this, but we do. We need incredible help. Now check this out, because verse 23 gives us help. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. Now some of you ladies might be thinking, well, that's a very dangerous statement in light of how hard you're telling us it is for men to love their wives. When you have men that find difficulty loving their wives, and now you're saying it's a verse like this, this is kind of scary. I think we can all see right off. Maybe it is scary. But by the grace of God, we can press through this, and I think we'll see some good and valuable things. Now, I think we can all see that love isn't even mentioned in verse 23. But you know what? This verse, it does do something for us. It shows us what role the husband is to take as a lover of his wife. Here's the thing. Paul simply knows nothing of a husband trying to love his wife in any other context than that of headship. Do you all see that? I mean, he says the husband is the head in verse 23. Verse 25, husbands, love your wives. Verse 23, the husband is head of the wife. Before Paul tells husbands to love their wives, he says the husband is the head of the wife. Men, massively helpful to us. Throws tremendous light on how we must love our wives. Provided, of course, that we understand what being a head means. But here's the thing. Let's suppose the concept of headship is absolutely foreign to all of us. Suppose we've never even heard there is such a thing as headship. We come here to Paul's words. The husband is the head of the wife. We all scratch our heads and we look at one another and we're just bewildered, confused. We ask, what does that mean? Well, I think Paul would say to us, oh, look what I say. Look, brethren, let's read verses 20 through 24 together. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. Now, I grant you, the ESV supplies the word submit there. In the original, it's drawing off the word given in the previous verse where it says we're to submit one to another. So it's implied here. The ESV fills it in because it is indeed implied. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Look at verse 24. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should in everything to their husbands. Again, submit is added there, but it's implied again from the first part of 24. So our ESV shows the word submit twice where it's implied. But still, it's there. It's implied. Submission, subjection, obedience to. That's what that word means. Because the husband... Now watch this. Because the husband is head of the wife should submit to her husband. So whatever headship is, it at least means this. It means superior rank in the family. The husband ranks over the wife in the sense that the wife is to submit to the husband. God has granted authority to the man to rule in the family, to rule over his wife, and Christ, of course, in all of this, Christ is the prototype. Men are to imitate Christ. I mean, he's saying, men, do this as Christ does this. This whole relationship is to look like that of Christ. So we ask this question. He says, even as the church submits to Christ, do we find that in our Bibles? Do we find the church submitting to Christ? Do we find Christ expecting the church to submit to him? Oh, brethren, it's everywhere. Luke 6:46, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I tell you? You see, he's saying, look, if you're going to call me Lord, if you're going to come into my kingdom, if you're going to regard me as the master, you're going to regard me as the Lord, why would you even call me that if you're not going to do what I say? You see, that's implied in Christianity. This is heart and soul. Hebrews 5:9, being made perfect, Jesus, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. John 3:36, whosoever believes in the Son has eternal life. Whoever does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God remains on him. Brethren, obedience just flows out of the Scriptures. 1 John 2:3, by this we know that we have come to know him, if we keep his commandments. John 14:21, whoever has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me. John 12:26, if anyone serves me, he must follow me. Again, follow me is calling men to walk like he walks, to walk in his ways, to walk in his words, to abide in his truth. Brethren, it's everywhere. And here's the thing. When you come back to Ephesians 5, verse 32, Paul says all of this is profound. Already he's teaching us about husbands and wives meant to say something about Christ and the church. You see, brethren, we're back to this. Nothing about marriage is arbitrary. Nothing about it's random. Nothing about its design is by chance. Our marriage is designed by God to do nothing other than put the gospel on display. That's why it's essential that men be the head in the family and the wife submits, because it portrays the glorious reality of Christ leading his bride. Peter says, 1 Peter 3:7, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. Do you realize God says the woman is the weaker vessel? Why? Because he designed it that way. Brethren, that's not arbitrary. This is just meant to explode with the truth of a mighty Christ as head of his church, and a church who in weakness finds Christ to be her all and submissively follows him. So to capture this reality, the husband's love is always to flow from the vantage point of strength and headship. The husband is to love as one in authority. We're talking about love-motivated leadership. And if that's not the picture, then the whole thing becomes distorted. The whole portrayal of Christ in all this and his relationship to the church is lost. So husbands, here's what Paul's saying in this. We must not attempt to lead without love, nor attempt to love without leading. And I want to hit on this first one. Men, if you try to lead without love, I mean, I called this message love-motivated leadership. And I can tell you this. If love doesn't motivate your leadership, what will? Hands down, every time, what will? What is it? Pride. Yeah, selfishness. Self. Self-serving, self-gratification, self-pleasure, self-preservation will motivate your leadership if love doesn't. Hands down, brethren, every time. Whether it's in the family, whether it's in the church, whether it's in the government, wherever it is, if men try to lead without love, it becomes inevitably an abuse of authority. Abusive authority. An abuse of authority. That's what it degenerates into every time. I just pull some examples out. Brethren, do you remember this? Some of you more familiar with your Bibles will. Judges 19. Don't turn there. It's an extended portion. But you remember this. There's this Levite. And he goes off and he finds his concubine. A concubine is like an inferior wife. I mean, technically they were married, but there were some inferiorities there, and you'd have to look at some of the cultural aspects of that to see what the differences were. But this guy, this Levite, he's got this concubine, technically a wife. And you remember, they're basically looking for a place to stay at night, and he doesn't want to go anywhere but into a city of Israel. And so he goes to Gibeah of Benjamin. And he goes in there, and you remember, he goes into the town square or whatever, and he's sitting there, and he's got his horses and his servant and his concubine, and nobody will take him in. In fact, wicked men lived in that place. But you got this guy, and he's sojourning there, and he comes back from work in the fields, and he sees him there, and he says, "Come to my house. Sir, I'll take care of you." And you remember what happens. They're in there, it says they're drinking and they're eating and they're making merry. When all of a sudden all these wicked guys from the city come, homosexuals it seems, they want to lay with the guy. Well, the guy, the old man says, "No, my brothers, do not act so wickedly since this man has come into my home. Do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughters and his concubine." Brethren, there's something wrong with that. Wouldn't you agree? Let's go further. "Let me bring them out now. Violate them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing." Now I'm moving the attention off the old guy to the Levite who owned this woman. She was his concubine. And typically with concubines, there was more of the aspect of ownership than maybe so much with marriage. But the men would not listen to the old guy, so the man, the younger guy, seized his concubine and made her go out to them. Now let me ask you this. Was that love-motivated leadership? You know what? You know why he did that? Self-preservation. You see what it degenerates into? Listen to how the story goes. Some of you maybe never heard this. "And they knew her and abused her. Brethren, they raped her all night long until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where his master was until it was light. And her master rose up in the morning. And when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying on the door of the house with her hands on the threshold." Listen to what he says to her. Not even, "Are you okay?" He said to her, "Get up, let us be going." But there was no answer. Anybody find anything wrong with that? Anybody find, like, maybe that's like 10 million miles away from the kind of leadership Christ has with his church? Brethren, you see what happened there? That's not love. He led. You see how he led? He commanded her to go out. He led. He set up the rules. He told her to go out there. He was in charge. But you see, brethren, when it degenerates and love no longer, love didn't dictate that action for his concubine or his wife. Something else did. That's how it degenerates. Brethren, I saw this statistic on the internet. Domestic violence is the single major cause of injury to women in America. Nearly one quarter of women in the United States, that's more than 12 million, will be abused by a current or former partner sometime during their lives, according to the American Medical Association. Listen, brethren, do you realize what's being said here? The very men who should be protecting, sheltering, honoring, loving these women are the very men that are hurting them. And that's what happens when leadership degenerates from love motivated to something else motivated. That's what it degenerates. You remember Ahasuerus? Anybody remember him? Who was he? In the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days, King Ahasuerus sat in his royal throne in Susa, the capital. This comes out of Esther. Now listen, in all the provinces of his kingdom, some of you know the story, but this thing goes on. This man gathered all the beautiful young virgins into his harem. One of these happened to be Esther. Basically, when the turn came for each of these young women to go into King Ahasuerus, in the evening she would go in the morning she would return to the second harem. She would not go to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. You get the feeling there? Ahasuerus used his headship to use these women solely for his pleasure. And if he didn't find pleasure in them, they never came again. He used them, and that was it. Brethren, that is what the world does. That's how its thinking is. Basically, when it becomes other than love motivated, then it becomes that kind of thing. Now, brethren, not every man has the power. He doesn't have the power in his hands to be able to do that. But basically, that is what is in the heart of man when he is not love motivated in his leadership. Consider Judah. Judah, this guy has a son, God kills him, leaves a widow, goes to the next son, God kills him, leaves a widow, he promises a third son, doesn't work out, she realizes the promise has been made, she kind of, she goes out, she dresses up like a prostitute, here comes Judah. Judah says, hey, there's a prostitute. Looks like I ought to take advantage of this situation. And so in there he goes. And she conceives. 3 months later, it's found she's with child. And do you know the first words out of his mouth? Burn her with fire. Oh, wait, Judah. Did you forget you went into the prostitute? Did you forget about your own sexual immorality? But again, brethren, I realize Tamar was not his wife. It was his daughter-in-law. But inevitably, they had children together through this deal. But you see what happens when he had leadership in that family? He determined that she needed to be burned. Well, come on, that's kind of unfair. That's a double standard. But you see that basically that standard will become double. Ahasuerus wasn't in a harem for somebody else. He wasn't willing to be used like that. He wasn't willing to be abused like that. You know, the Levite could have rescued his concubine and himself gone out there, but he didn't. He sacrificed her. Islam. I think most of us are aware of the loveless leadership so common in Islam. Muslim man by the name of Kamran Miman. This is a Muslim. He's writing about Islam himself. He's writing about it. He says this: although supposedly Islam promises women protection from such problems, the reality in many Muslim homes is different. I quote him: the most common form of abuse is emotional and mental abuse. In Muslim homes, this includes verbal threats to divorce the wife and to remarry somebody else. I added somebody else. Or to take the kids away if she does not do exactly as she is told. Intimidation and threats of harm, degradation, humiliation, insults, ridicule, name-calling and criticism, false accusations, and blaming her for everything, ignoring, dismissing, or ridiculing her needs, neglect and the silent treatment, spying on her, telling her she is a failure and will go to hell, twisting Islamic teachings to make her feel worthless because she's a woman, restricting her access to transportation, health care, food, clothing, money, friends, or social services, physical and social isolation. Now we can look at that and we can say, well, that's true of Islam, brethren. That's true of man naturally. By nature, why do you think Paul comes along and in very short, concise fashion, over in the Colossian letter, he gives extended information here in Ephesians, but in the Colossian letter he says, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Why in the world, of all the things he says not to be, why does he say that? Because, brethren, I'll tell you this, once leadership degrades, it's degraded into something less than love-motivated, it becomes self-motivated, and typically with self-motivated leadership, there comes harshness, there comes abusiveness. That's a natural outflow of this. Men by nature are harsh, they are cruel, they are insensitive, they are selfish. We want our pleasure, we want our way, we want to be served, but that is not the way we've learned Christ. And so, brethren, this is why this is such a huge thing, because Paul says, put off that old man. Put him off. And these are the huge tendencies to allow our leadership. Brethren, we cannot seek to lead without love motivating it. But on the other hand, we can try also to love without leading, and we end up with a neglect of authority. Husbands who try to be husbands by not leading. I'm not talking about a man who leads and commands and reigns over his wife with harshness and cruelty and insensitivity. Rather, now I'm talking about the tendency to simply drop the ball. Besides brutality and abusiveness, men also have this wicked tendency to simply neglect their responsibility. I'm talking about the man who's just lazy when it comes to the lead of his family. He's passive. Not active, like the verb says. He's just passive. He's neglectful. And brethren, you know this as well as I do. Men, they can walk around with their chest out. They can walk around and gloat over their batting averages or how much they can bench press or this or that. But when it comes down to it, the natural man is really a coward. And you know what? Men are afraid to lead. A lot of men are afraid of their wives. Probably a lot of men ought to be afraid of their wives, but that's no excuse. We've been given a God-given commandment to do this. Brethren, whatever the reason, this is a big problem. We've got this whole feminist thinking that permeates our day too. Men, we need to be courageous, step up to our God-given calling. You know, this started right at the beginning. Now I'm not talking about the brutality. I'm talking about the failure. And brethren, I see something of a failure right there at the beginning. Ladies, you tell me if you don't see this. Satan keyed in on Eve when her head, her protector, her leader was gone somewhere else. He took advantage. He came in right there. But brethren, I'll tell you this. Adam, when he found out what happened, he could have said, I will not eat. God said not to do this. I'm not following you, Eve. I'm the leader here. He failed. He stepped out. He let her take the lead. And not only that, but when God came, he went to Adam first. And Adam basically said he didn't stand there side by side with his wife and say, I'm standing one with her. I'm responsible. I'm the head. I'm the leader. I'm going to answer for her. She's my wife. The two of us are one. You know what he did? He stepped away from her. You see that, right? He said, the woman you gave me. It's your fault, God. It's her fault. He basically stepped away. Brethren, abandoned his wife. When the going just got tough, Adam distanced himself from his wife. A man who is head of his wife sticks by her no matter how hard things get. He doesn't vacate. When an army suffers a defeat and that general has to go in and stand before the president and give an account, you don't distance yourself and say, well, it's the troops. If you're the leader, you've got to give an account. You've got to stand with the troops. If they failed, you hang your head with them. If she failed, you put your arm around her and say, I know it was my responsibility. In the first place, he should have never followed. He advocated, brethren. And I'll tell you, there's a couple other examples of this too. You remember Abraham. Abraham's going down to Egypt. And Abraham gets fearful. You see, we need to be courageous if we're going to lead. This is why men advocate. This is why men quit. In the day of trouble, when the going gets tough, when things get hard, they advocate because they fear. They don't have that faith. They don't have that humble confidence in God. Here you got Abraham, the friend of God. He's coming down there to Egypt. He looks at his wife. He said, you know what? I'm afraid. I think they're going to kill me because you're so beautiful. And he says, don't claim to be my wife. Claim to be my sister. You see, again, he stepped away from her. And you know what Pharaoh did? He took her. Listen, it was not Abraham's doing that she was spared. It was only God intervening. If God would not have intervened on two occasions, she would have ended up being defiled by another man. Because he advocated. There he was. And you know what? His son did the same thing. Here comes Isaac. Same things. Looks at Rebecca and says, you're too beautiful. Brethren, this is not the way it is with leadership in the kingdom. This is not the way we've learned Christ. Leadership in the kingdom looks different. When love motivates that leadership, we don't make our wife go outside to get raped. We don't abandon her when the danger comes. Let me show you what I mean. There are two places in 2 Corinthians where Paul talks about his authority. Now, I know Paul was an apostle and his authority was with the church. But what I want to show you is because Christ is the example to the husband. Everything literally in leadership falls out of Christ as the example. And the whole point is the way Paul led the church reflects back to how Christ leads. The way the husband leads the family reflects back to the way Christ leads, because he's the example in all of this. We can basically look at leadership in any aspect of his kingdom and see that basic leadership is like his leadership. He is the example of it. And so it just reflects back onto all manner of leadership. And so if you find leadership is a way in one area, it reflects right back to the way it is for us husbands. Here's what the apostle says. He says in 2 Corinthians 13:10, for this reason I write these things while I am away from you, that when I come I may not have to be severe in my use of the authority that the Lord has given me. You see that? He's been given authority over the church at Corinth. Sometimes That authority requires severity. You realize that? Listen, if you're going to lead men, sometimes your leadership has to be severe. But listen to what he says. The authority that the Lord has given me for building up, not for tearing down. Oh, brethren, didn't Jesus say it like this? He said to his disciples, you are not to be like the leaders of the Gentiles. What do? They lord it over. They want to be supreme. You see, the Gentiles rule, the lost man rules, just like Ahasuerus, for his own gain, what he can get out of it. But Jesus says, I give my authority so that those with the authority can build up others, not tear them down, not use them, not destroy them, but to build them up. Brethren, at times those in authority no doubt need to be severe, but even that severity is always for the sake of building up. Not severity that hurts, not severity that's brutal, rash, tears down, destroys, humiliates. Men, you know what this requires? It requires us to lead by design. How often do you men do that? How often are you actually being a husband by design? You are leading in order to build up and to lead your wife in calculated fashion. Not just hit and miss, not just randomly, but with purpose, lovingly seeking the maturity, the progress, the Christ-likeness, the growth. Then, of course, Jesus says this when he's talking. I mean, secondly, he says not just that the authority is for building up. When he's talking there about the authority of the Gentiles and how they lord it over them, you know that Jesus gets to the end of that and he says, again, I'm the example. I'm the example of this leadership. I came not to be served, but to serve. But see, somebody's going to come, a man's going to come along and say, well, that doesn't sound like much of an authority. That doesn't sound like much of a leader if I'm doing all the serving. I mean, if I'm running around serving my wife all the time, I'm not going to look a whole lot like a leader. But brethren, don't you remember John 13? John 13, Jesus, he girds his loins. He gets down on his knees and he takes that wash basin. He begins to wash the disciples' feet. Now, brethren, if you were looking in the window and somebody said, what do you see in there? I think I see a slave in there washing their master's feet. If you just had a snapshot, that's what it looked like. But I'll tell you this, if you were in that room, if you just read John 13, nobody in that room had any doubt about who the leader was. I guarantee you that. Brethren, we can serve without losing our manhood. We can serve without losing our leadership. In fact, when you have the authority, it means you are the one making the decisions. You are deciding how you are going to serve. You are deciding how you are going to build up. You're deciding these things. You have this principle laid down in 1 Peter 5. Again, leadership in the kingdom. 1 Peter 5, 2. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you. And I know this is to elders. Exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you. Not for shameful gain, but eagerly. Listen to this. Not domineering over those in your charge, but being example to the flock. You see, this is another trait of leadership in the kingdom. Leading by example. Brethren, the grand pattern of example, again, is Christ. In his headship, he says to his church, he calls to them, follow me. Men, can you say that to your wives? Can you say that? Because in purpose, in character, men, you cannot call your wife to follow you if you don't know where you're going. You can't be just wandering around, no objective, no vision, no goal, no direction. We need husbands that know where they're going, where they mean to take their wife, how they mean to build them up, what the objective is, what the end is. That's the grand pattern. Do you know where you're going? You've got to know where you're headed if you're going to call this woman of yours to follow you. Brethren, we need men of character. We need men of faith to walk like this. Listen, you know where Abraham stumbled? You know why he vacated? Faith. Faith. God was able to protect him, and he did supernaturally. He came in there among that Philistine king, Abimelech, and he gave him a dream. He told him, you touch that woman, you're a dead man. But if God's able to do that, don't you think God was quite able to protect Abraham if he'd have walked in there and said, this is my wife, leave your hands off her, and protect her and stand up and take his leadership? You see, he failed because of a lack of faith. We need men that are strong in faith. You know what that results? That results in men who have courage, men who have confidence. Brethren, men who when their wife says, I want to go this way. The children say, I want to go this way. The mother-in-law is over there saying, go that way. We need men with courage, with confidence in the Lord, who are going to say, I hear you, but I've been studying this word, and God says to go that way. And I'm going. We need men like that. Brethren, men of courage. Just recently, every once in a while, I love to watch that old Martin Luther movie. I love that. He's in the diet of worms. Brethren, we need men like that. My conscience, he said, it's not wise, it's not safe to violate your conscience. He said his conscience was bound by that word of God. Here I stand. God help me. Brethren, we need that. We need that. Faith, that confidence. Not where we bully, we see that. Not where we bully our wives, not where we're domineering, but in confidence in the Lord. Faith, men of integrity, men of honesty, men who set the standard, not liars, not men whose word isn't any good, not men like these we find all over Islam, not just cruel, not characterized by that. We need men of courage, humble courage to do what's right, even when it's not easy, when popular opinion's against you. We're not talking, brethren, loud and proud, but men who hear their wives, they weigh out, they look to them as helpers, and they say, you know what? Sometimes they're able, in humility, to say, God sent my wife to take me off a path that was not going to be good. And to admit that, God used my wife, but also at times saying, wife, I've heard you, I love you, and because I do, we're going to go this way. I trust the Lord, it's going to work. I trust the Lord, this is the right way. Men, we've got to be students of Christ to live this out. You've got to be sitting at the feet of Christ. You've got to be learning. You've got to apply what you learn. You must think. You must act. You must pray. You must not be passive. We've got to be aggressive in this. We need to look to Christ. This is where it is, brethren. Love-motivated leadership. You extract the love, it turns ugly and defective. You extract the leadership and try to leave the love. See, it's defective. It's no good. Both, brethren, that's what God has called us to. Both. You see that, right? Amen. You're dismissed.